guys, welcome back to another episode of Unleashed. And remember, we are the resistance. And it is so good to have you guys here. We are getting into warmer temperatures, and I'm so done with wintertime. You know, if I'm in a tree stand, that's one thing. But once hunting season is over for me, I'm just like, I'm ready to get the Indy 500s coming up this next weekend. And I think, Eric, do you go to the Indy 500?
Man, I like to go to Carb Day.
Yeah, I'll be there Carb Day on Friday.
But, man, that...
The traffic.
Well, it's the whole thing, man, and they're kind of cracking down with rules and, you know, the cooler stuff. It's like, I know. Yeah. When you could drive your truck into the infield and park, and, you know, that was different, but...
It used to be crazy. I don't know if you remember that. Well, they kind of brought back the snake pit, but the snake pit was crazy. Back in the 80s, 70s, 80s, I mean, it was just nuts. But I'm a huge race fan. And Connor Daly, my buddy Derek Daly, his son, you know, is in the 500, qualified again. He's been in there many, many times. He hasn't won. He's led, I think, one race. He led, I think it was like 48 or 50 laps.
Yeah.
And he was coming out. I think he was getting ready. He came out of pit road, and someone clipped the back of him, and it slowed him down. But, yeah, I love it. I love the race. I love adventure. I love all that fun stuff.
Yeah, man. I don't connect with NASCAR, but IndyCar racing, Formula One racing.
Yeah, I mean, I like both. The thing I love about IndyCar is, you know, with the open wheel, it's not, you know, not so much. There's a draft, obviously there is. You know, when you see them snaking through when they get past the pagoda and stuff. But yeah, I like both. I do. I grew up watching sprint cars, and I just love that, the action with that. Well, anyhow. Let's kind of move into today. Today's podcast, the title of this is Decoys of Deception. And I'll tell you more about that in just a minute. And I'm going to introduce our guest today. Just an amazing guy, like one of those jack of all trades, you know. It's like he can do just about anything. And so today on the podcast, we've got, should I call you Dr. Jimmy Sites, or can
just, I? No, just Jimmy.
Just Jimmy.
Jimmy's fine.
It's like if it was like Will Primos. Yeah, I'd be like, Jimmy. Anyhow, today's podcast, it's going to hit home for a lot of you guys, you know, who really love the outdoors, love the thrill of the hunt. And there's a battle that is raging, you know, for the hearts and souls and the minds of men. And Jimmy, I'll read a little bit of your podcast here in a second, but we have been both, you know, kind of communicating off and on through the years. You know, we both kind of do the same thing in different ways. But it's nice to have someone. I know Steve Chapman, he and I go back and forth, you know, Steve, doing a lot of game dinners and men's conferences. But it's a lot of preparation, but it's not so much necessary about what you're going to say. The stories come easy. You know, when you have a chance to get out there and you put together the stories, the thing that can become the battle, and we'll talk a little bit about this, Jimmy, I'll ask you about what it's like for you, is, you know, the enemy always has his foot in the door somewhere. Everything can be going perfect. Mm-hmm. It'll be a sound issue, it'll be a car, a flight, something. And, wow, but, you know, I think I'll have a feeling you can probably resonate with this. God wins. I mean, when those kind of things come up, yeah. Well, man, let me get into your bio. So I'm going to read this here for a second. Dr. Jimmy Sites is a seasoned communicator, theologian, and a world-traveled outdoorsman. He's spoken in over 25 countries to audiences ranging from NFL to Major League Baseball teams to Fortune 500 companies, churches, government leaders, and wild game dinners. He's also served as a preaching minister in Nashville and has been a spokesman for Compassion International for over 30 years. I think the world of them. Jimmy is best known as the producer and the host of Spiritual Outdoor Adventures, which I'm sure many of you watch. It ran for, is it 22 seasons? Does that sound right? Sure. 22 seasons. Wow.
Yep.
Everything I remember from the Amazon, in the jungle, back to the Holy Land. Now, tell me how, Amanda, how does this work with both of you guys? How do you do all this?
Well, Amanda is my, you know, my best friend. She's my life soulmate. She's my partner. She's the partner in ministry, everything else. So Amanda is just, she quit teaching school. Actually, she went back to teaching public school so we could make it. When we started Spiritual Outdoor Adventures, when I stepped out of the big pulpit and didn't have any income for 3.5 years, we lived on Amanda's school teaching money. And then once the TV show took off and I could make a living doing it, then she stopped teaching after about 12 years total of eighth grade science, public school. And she has helped all the way through. Whenever we need something, she's there. She is like, she's on a ton of the episodes. She does the cooking part. Sometimes she'll do the, she's actually hunting. Sometimes she's painting. But she's just right in the middle of all of it. You know, we wouldn't have Spiritual Outdoor Adventures without Amanda. Really, it ought to be Spiritual Outdoor Adventures with Jimmy and Amanda.
Right.
That's really what the title ought to be. You know,
I get it.
I just realized I've.
Oh, we just paused. Something happened. Are you back?
Yep, I'm back.
Yeah,
sorry about that. I don't know what happened, but anyway, I got where I. Now you can see my eyes. Sorry about that. I had my sunglasses on. I just now realized it. I'm sitting here in what some would call a wife beater shirt, a redneck shirt,
because right.
I'm literally 100 yards from the beach right now. But I'm thrilled to be on your podcast, Brent.
Well, man, so you were talking about your wife come alongside, and I don't think a lot of people understand that, especially when you're in ministry, whether it's itinerant ministry, whether you're on staff at a church, you know, your spouse, the support that you get from her is the backbone to everything you do. You cannot do it without them.
100%.
And I don't know if you guys ever...
I can't imagine doing it without her, yeah.
Yeah, and those conversations, you know, I know that Stacy and I have to be really careful to make sure, you know, it is God, then my wife, then my family, and then the ministry.
Yes.
Because, you know, yes. I mean, when you get absolutely. So busy with a book or an episode or something, you can get consumed.
Yeah. Oh, man. So easy. I know so many fellows that their ministry came first instead of their family. And it's not just the wife that they lost their kids. And, you know, I love Toby Mac's song about, you know, don't go out and save the world and lose your own soul, because I think that's ultimately what you do. You know, you can lose your soul by pouring yourself into kingdom work if you're forfeiting your relationships with the people who mean the most.
I want to talk about that when we get a little bit further into this. You know, guys that are listening in, you know, right now to Unleashed, we really are so glad that you're here with us. And I think you're going to hear a lot of insights from Jimmy today that are going to hit a lot of you guys. It, you know, what was it John Eldridge talked about? You know, all men love adventure, but not every man's adventure looks exactly the same. And, you know, right. Jimmy, I know you from so many of the fishing trips or hunting, you know, trips that you've been on and watching that, because that's one of my passions. And I think a lot of, you know, at least my listeners love that too. But I want to get into, first I want to get something funny first. So when you think about all of the adventures, fishing, hunting, whatever, it could be something on the road. A lot of times, you know, the road trips are some of the funnest part. What would be one of the funniest things you've ever had happen to you when you've been out, you know, filming or adventuring?
Okay, that's a great question, because there's been so many of them, and I've had so many bloopers and done so many stupid things. But probably I was in the Amazon jungle. I had my wife, and I had my two biological kids before we adopted Mary. And I think Kristen was 16 and Jonathan would have been 13 or something like that. We were with the Alka tribe, the Weldani, the fiercest tribe in the history of the world. We're with Steve Saint. We're living in a longhouse with Minkai and Dabo and Kimo and Dewey. And these are the four of the five killers of the missionaries, Steve Saint's dad, Nate Saint, you know, those guys. I was there doing a documentary for the movie End of the Spear.
Yeah,
and I was showing where they are 50 years later. So Bill Ewing, the guy that did Spider-Man and Men in Black, he did the pre-movie documentary and then the movie, he and Mark Green, who owns Hobby Lobby and all that. Well, then Steve asked me to come in and basically photograph and video the tribe before they go away someday. And so it'd be kind of like getting to go back and be in Sitting Bull's camp, you know, and document everybody.
How many are still left? Curious, I mean, out of the tribe like that. How big is it?
There's about 200 of them that are God followers. They follow Wagonge God and Iatoto the Sun, and it's Wapani, which means I like it. And they live at, you know, Camp Wapani when they come together, and which they'll do a few times a year. It's just fascinating. But the other 1,800 of the Alka tribe, they live deeper in the jungle, and there's never been friendly contact made, and they'll kill you the second they see you. So it was quite a fascinating story. It was the one time in my life. If you said what's the scariest thing, I would say when I thought I was going to die.
That was the next question.
Yeah, that's the scariest one. But the funniest one was the first night we were there. We were so tired after traveling so long to get into the jungle, and you know, through dugout canoes and hiking and all that, and you're dehydrated. And we're sleeping in this longhouse that's actually used in the movie End of the Spear. That's the longhouse. And there's a vampire bat in there. You got to keep your head covered up with this wicker kind of blanket. And you're in a, what would you call it? hammock made out of reeds or straw. And yeah, it's not comfortable. And I just could not sleep, man. I tell you what, I was so tired. So the second night, I took 2 Tylenol PM and 2 Benadryl, so I would sleep. Not a great mixture, kind of a concoction. And boy, did I sleep. And I dreamt in the middle of that night that that Dabo, the world's fiercest warrior, who was asleep about 20 feet away next to my daughter and in his hammock, I mean, these are Stone Age Indians. They can't speak a word of English, and we can't understand anything they're saying. It's like, but I can understand Dabo, and he can understand Dabo. And Dabo had killed probably somewhere around 250 warriors in his lifetime. He was the greatest hunter in their history and all that kind of stuff, because he had actually 5 wives and families that he could care for. That's how good he could hunt. So here he is, 80-something years old, and he's a God follower now, sweetest old man. And he had come to the camp, I think 6 weeks early, and then another like 2 weeks early, and he had to go back 6 hours. And by the time he came the third time, he had probably pneumonia, and he's over there hacking his lungs out and all that. And he would get up in the middle of the night and hack and spit and sometimes just urinate right there in the longhouse. That's what Stone Age Indians do. And so that night, I heard Dabo get up in the middle of the night. You know, there's probably 40 of us in there. Steve Saint's just to my left, my wife's next to me. And I heard Dabo get up and hack and all that stuff. And then I heard him shuffling toward me because I'm between him and the door. And I'm thinking, well, he's going to go outside to relieve himself. And things all of a sudden got a little tense because he grabbed my toe. And he didn't just touch my toe. He grabbed my toe and kept working around my body along right up beside me and kind of stopped. And I'm all of a sudden thinking, he is reverting. He's about to drive a spear through my heart, because that's how they killed people, with these spears they made. And I mean, I just started screaming, and it was louder than a little girl or anything. It was so high pitched. They said they'd never heard anything like it. And I was like, Dabo's got my toe. Dabo's got my toe. Dabo's going to kill me. Ah! And I'm just going crazy. And finally, you know, I woke everybody up. And of course, Dabo, he's hearing this. Well, it was my daughter. And she said, Dad, it's me, Kristen. I have your toe. I'm trying to go outside to find the restroom, which there was no restroom. And so everybody is just laughing. Dabo only heard Dabo. He didn't know what else was going on. He just know this guy's screaming. And so finally, you know, I just go right back to sleep. I did it again, and Steve comes over and shakes me. Jimmy, be quiet. So I sleep. I don't even remember it because I'm so out of it. Well, the next morning, we go out under this makeshift, like, pavilion made out of pine stuff or whatever, palms. And they are throwing me under the bus, man. That, you know, Dabo's got my toe. He's going to kill me. Ah, Steve, help me out. If you'd have been there, it would have been a lot funnier. But it truly was, in the moment, probably when you're like, oh, yeah, I'm this macho outdoors guy. You know, look at me.
You need to write a song about that. Dabo's got my toe.
Yeah, I think so.
I think that'd be a good one.
You and I both play, right? You play. Yeah. You write and sing.
Yep.
Well, I can write and play, but you sing. All right. So, I don't sing much.
That's another lie. You know what's amazing is, for so many years, that's what I did. You know, you probably know some of my story, but I was in music for a long time, Christian music, in the studio.
Right.
And when God got a hold of me, you know, and he said, you know, I've got a different mission for you. It's the same purpose, you know, and spreading his word to people. But through the ministry of the outdoors to men was something I'm like, can I really do what I love?
Yeah.
And the next thing you know, I probably saw in, I don't know, 20 years of being in music ministry, this is going to sound terrible, maybe 20 people got saved. I mean that's awesome. Really? But in speaking to guys in probably the last 12-13 years, I've seen probably close to 20,000 guys give that. You know, I mean, at these events, they bring the guys in that would never darken the door of a church.
I tell you, man, I got the same story. I was a pulpit minister at a 5,000 member church. I had a TV show called Amazing Grace Bible Class, Suit and the Tie Show. I'm preaching to Christians. I'm preaching to people that are saved all the time. And you know what got me out of that was God basically just kind of gave me this vision in my heart that said, look, you got 99 sheep in the pen that are safe, but you got one out there that's not. You're shepherding the 99. You need to go find the one that was lost. And so that's ultimately what bumped me over to begin and launch Spiritual Outdoor Adventures, so I could get into the living room of a person, a man in particular, who doesn't go to church. Maybe he's had a bad experience with church. Maybe he's never really given God a try. How do you get in there and talk with him? You can't knock on his door and he's going to let you in. So how do you get in? Through the TV. And how do you get him to watch? Through a really exciting outdoor adventure show where you're hunting and fishing. And you got celebrities on there willing to, you know, talk about their faith. So we had tons of different people that were willing to do that, you know?
I think it was...
I mean, literally, I'm looking at a launching rent right now where Tony Dungy and I put a boat in and went deep sea fishing right there.
Oh, when he lives Dungy real close the show, to there. That's right. Watch. Yeah, he's in Tampa. Yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah, sure is.
Wow.
You got Duck Dynasty, Phil Robertson, you know, we're filming the blind and he's talking. Man, when the guys see that, they lock on that remote and stay on that channel. Yep. And so that's how we did it, you know.
I know you
entertain in order to educate, in order to inspire.
Yeah, you have to walk that line because you know, when you have all the different famous people or whatever, and you have to kind of walk in humility. It's like there's this fine line between name dropping and saying, no, this is an influence to men who will listen to them. That's and if exactly I can build trust with them, then they'll listen about Christ. So that's what
I will be the first to say I've been guilty of name dropping. I do not want to be a part of that. It's
I think
right.
we can all do that.
I've done it because I'm trying to get a leg up in the industry that's super hard to make a living in. And then, you know, my son or my wife or one of my board members will say, hey, no. That's not how you do it. And I've got this amazing accountability group, you know, including some very close friends that are pastors, people like you that are willing to tell me, man, hey, your breath stinks or whatever it is that they need to say. And I am willing to listen. You know, I just need a wake up call every once in a while.
You know what you just said a second ago.
But at the same time, you're right. There is some credibility factor.
Yeah.
In people who are willing to be on, and you do have to advertise, and you also have to promote yourself in some ways, which I hate to do.
I know.
You just have to learn how to walk that tightrope, you know?
I was thinking a second ago when you and I started talking, and you said, well, you play, don't you, and sing, and that kind of stuff. The old me, you know, in the flesh, and I'll just say this on here, because, it's sometimes when you're doing a podcast, you know, it takes a while, like almost at a speaking event, where you're kind of up here getting people going, right? And then eventually you get real. And my wife's been the one challenging me, saying, honey, she's like, why can't you start getting real sooner when you speak? She's been working on me for a couple of years with that. And I'm just going to be honest, when you said that a second ago, just kind of showing how the enemy can mess with us, you know, the temptation for me, you know, it's basically what we call like the one-upping. We know what we're talking about as men, whether it's, hey, look at my deer, look at my fish, look at who I've sung with. You know, the enemy was whispering to me a second ago, you know, Brent, say who you toured with or fill in the blanks. I don't even need to go into detail, but the enemy loves to mess because our worth and value gets entrenched and entangled with the performance stuff. And I was thinking it was 2020. Yep. I was speaking in Minnesota for it was a men's retreat. And they said, hey, next year we've got Jimmy Seitz coming in. And I said, oh, you're going to love Jimmy. But that's when COVID hit. And I was going to ask you this. It reminded me. Do you remember speaking up there for a men's conference? And I think it would have been for you. It would have been like 2021. But I don't know if COVID canceled it that year or whether you still did it.
In Minnesota?
Yeah.
Where was that?
I can't think of the name of the camp. Beautiful. Big lake there.
Yeah. I know the one you're talking about. Yes. I think I ended up speaking at that. There's been so many of them, and they all start running together. But I have been to Minnesota a couple of times in the last 2 or 3 years. So I bet you this is the one you were talking about.
Well, Jimmy, with everything that you've done... and it's a lot. I was thinking about like when I'm hunting, for instance, and you have a new piece of property and maybe it takes 3, 4, 5 years to really learn the property well and until you know exactly how your entrance and exit needs to be, you know, how to play the winds on that property, whether you got swirling or straight line or whatever you got going on. But it's like when that aha moment hits and you finally figured the property out, right? Then you know where to hang your stands. Mm-hmm. I was kind of bringing this back to, with the ahas in your life, with all of the stuff that you've done, because I think it's easy for us to be able to talk about, you know, the things that we've done or done well or people know about, but it's that stuff that they don't know about that can have the most impact in that person listening to us when we can really talk about, you know what, it's easy for me to let you see this side of me, but I'm going to let you see some of the underside. And I know that with what you do and following Christ and leading people, there's a big why behind what you do. And I know that when we find our why, you know, and I talk about this a lot, it's that thing that we can't not do. It's something that God made us for, that we're passionate. We wake up with it. We go to sleep with it.
Yep.
My question for you on that is, Is there a moment or moments you can look at it, like a hitting bottom moment or something where you go, you know what, that is when grace popped off the page and my life changed?
Boy, there's probably more than one of those. Yeah. You know, I think about all the things I went through as a pastor. I was fired twice. And one of those was at the really big church with 5,200 members. And we were doing great work. The church had grown from 1,400 to 5,200 in 3 years. We were baptizing 250, you know, prostitutes and people off the streets every year. Things were good. But what happened is there was this massive war that just took place inside the membership. And we had some pseudo Christians there. We had some wolves that had made their way in sheep's clothing and made their way into leadership. And it got extremely volatile. We were on CNN twice.
Oh, wow.
And we were in the news. And I mean, it was crazy. I had death threats and had to have undercover security for 6 weeks. So it got extremely big time bad. And this was from 1998 to 2000. And so I did hit rock bottom when the coup took place and they got me fired. And I say that, you know, tongue in cheek, fired. They really couldn't get rid of me. And I was still there another 2 years, but in a different role to hold the church together because, man, it started to just bust and split, you know. But God said, nope, you're going to stay here and you're going to help hold it together. And by the time it's all done, you're going to just fold your tent and ease out and everything's going to be good. And that's what happened, but it was the hardest thing I ever did in my life. My wife couldn't even go to church hardly. My kids started going to a different church. And yet I had to keep going there because God said, do it. And I hated it, man, I'm telling you. But here's the key, all right? That was the most humbling thing because I don't know how to say this in any other way, but my life up to that point in my 20s and 30s, everything was going right. The athletic career, the music, everything, the writing. You know, I wrote a book when I was 23 that I didn't think anybody would buy, and it sold 65,000 copies. Yeah. I mean, I couldn't do anything wrong, you know, as far as that kind of stuff. And so the label that people were putting on me is, oh, he's the golden boy, you know, within my denomination.
Right.
And that's something that they really always had one of those people in that denomination. And, well, I was him, you know. And if you think that doesn't go to the head of somebody in their 30s. And so all of this, you know, I'm trying to stay humble. I'm trying to stay me. And yet, you know, by the time it was all said and done, I was crushed, man. I mean, I was devastated. And I had to come home for the second time and tell my wife, I don't have a job. And that lady needs security, man. You know,
I know that.
And you don't want your kids falling prey to all the crud that goes on in ministry because there's a bunch. So you try to shield them from it. And I felt that I was failing. I felt like a failure, Brent. I felt like I had hit rock bottom and was just, I was so mad at God. I remember finally yelling at him in the shower. You know, why did you let this all happen? And that was my moment. That was the moment that, you know, God basically said to me the same thing that I think he said to Bildad and those guys with Job. And he says, but you don't have any right to question me. You know, so I got this, you know. And so from that moment, it began to swing back. And that's when I started Spiritual Outdoor Adventures. And he had tried to get me to do it for 10 years. And I've been playing with it. But it took him doing that to me to get me to make that jump and do what I did. And the ministry that I've been involved with now for the last 22 years, 23 now, is exponentially broader and more effective than anything I'd ever done.
And there's probably a lot more joy.
I thought my life was over. I thought my ministry was over. I joked and said, man, I got a doctorate and I can't even get a job at Chick-fil-A. You know, and I'm serious. That's how I felt because nobody was going to have me in my denomination that I came out of, you know. But it was also a really great amazing time spiritually because it did move me in a direction. And I remember getting a phone call from a musician that you know, and I'm not going to name drop. And the dude's awesome. I love the guy. And he said, man, I'm starting this new church and I need a teacher. And I was like, oh, I'd love to. He said, well, I mean, can you volunteer? We don't have any money to pay. And I said, I'd love to. I need a place to kind of grow and heal and teach. And yeah. And it was the next 7 years were absolutely spiritually amazing. I was like a baby being raised all over again. And since that time, of course, there's always these kind of moments, but I feel like my life since that time up to the point that I'm now 63 has just been like rocket growth. And I realized because of that, man, I got so much to learn and so much to grow. And as I was writing this new book, you know, they told me, hey, we want 225 pages. And you know how publishers are. Yep. They got it all figured out, what'll sell and everything. And I got to page 225 and it was still dark. This is a book on the origin of evil. This is a book about Satan. It was still dark. I was at the end of the dark, but it was still dark. I mean, you finish reading, you don't feel all that great. And I just kept on going because God just started pouring into me. And he used the Apostle John. And I saw things like in Revelation and in 2 John and 3 John. This is the whole last third of the book. I saw things that I'd never seen before. And I was getting so excited. And man, God was waking me up at 4 a.m. every morning. And I'm writing until noon. And he's just pouring it on. And the book ends up being 303 pages. And you know what? I just told the publisher, it is what it is. Print it, you know? I feel like it's the best section of the whole book. And for me personally, it's been one of the greatest spiritual growing moments in my life. And I realize how young spiritually I am and how I'm kind of moving out of my preschool period, and I'm ready to really rock and roll now. Spiritually.
Yeah, it was about 3 a.m. I think it was in January, because you know when you're a writer, whether you're writing a song, whether you're writing a book, you hit that writer's block. And you know, like we can tell our stories. We have you always have to be making new stories. I mean, where you're at now, you're probably going to be making new stories, because the more you speak, the more material you have to keep having. And it's amazing when I think about, I get writer's block sometimes when I'm not out there doing the stuff that I need to be talking about. And God is like, you know, why is it that I feel shame sometimes, you know, when you get to go on some of these trips, you're doing it because God's saying, no, I'm sending you on this because you're going to be meeting people. You're going to be gathering things that are going to be changing lives. And so it was about, it was in January, it was about, I don't know, I had writer's block. I was working on a new book, and I just kind of quietly went to my office the night before, and I got down on my knees. I shut the door and I said, God, I said, I'm writing a lot about you, but I'm not talking a lot to you. And I said, I think I get so busy in trying to write stuff and what people will like or what will move them. And what you go is, no, I want your heart to move towards me. And so I just said, I need you. I can't do this anymore. And it was one of those moments where God allows you to get to that place where you go, I can't keep trying to make something up. I need a relationship with you. And the deepest relationship, maybe you were the same way, was because I had one of those church experiences too like that. And it was when I was literally curled up in the fetal position wanting to die, that I realized God was holding me in his lap the whole time.
That's right.
I never felt closer.
And he does. Yep.
Well, man, I want to kind of move into your book a little bit. I had a chance to get one of the proofs, you know, from this, and I started going through it. It's been a busy weekend with what we've had going on here, but I spent some time when I was reading, you know, the beginning, like can I say anything from the book? Is that okay? Yeah, it's coming out, June 12th? Yeah.
It comes out June the 10th, right before Father's Day. And perfect. Study guide is about 109 page study guide. It goes with it.
And we're going to put that up on the screen. We'll have those links and everything so you guys can find this. Yeah. But as I was going through, Alaska has been one of my favorite places on the face of the earth.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, but you were talking about something that I'll be, if I get drawn again for, I'm going to be going in Colorado this fall. There's quite a few wolves in the area. And can you share just a little bit of that story, a little teaser with the book?
Oh yeah, absolutely. The opening story is one that has probably circulated for a very, very long time. I remember hearing it first when I was probably in my teens. And I don't know the exact source of that story. I wish I did. I don't think anybody does. So it's not new to me. It's not something that I experienced the trapper doing. But I took that story that I've been telling for 25 years. And it's the story of the old trapper and the ancient way of killing a wolf. And I won't give the details away, but it is the term that has come out of how to explain that story. It's dreadfully magnificent. I've had people come up to me 15 years after hearing me speak and go, I'll never forget that wolf story. Well, that opens the book. It's a good tease, so to speak, but it also sets everything up. And when I was in Alaska on one of my last trips, I was doing a bear hunt with one of the Band of Brothers guys from Afghanistan, and we both got big bears, and I was skinning mine when I actually, he said, there's a coyote. And I said, no, Doug, there are no coyotes in Alaska. Where's the wolf? And he pointed, and we could see this wolf going across the shallow river at about 325 yards. So I just had barely enough time to grab my PRC rifle and shoot it and dropped it. And that's the first time I've ever had a shot on a wolf. And so when I walked up on it, man, they're huge. They're majestic. I had such mixed emotions because wolves are so majestic. They're the top of the food chain, man. But at the same time, they were devastating that whole region of from the sitka deer and other things. And the DNR in Alaska said, if you're in the Ketchikan area, you don't even have to have a tag. We want you to kill every wolf on site that you possibly can, because we've got to get them back in check again and get them back in balance. So I was fortunate to get one. I was very happy as well as sad. But I do have that wolf hide, and I take it around with me to show people, and I use it, of course, you know, telling this story and others that I do. And it was really a fascinating moment that I'll never forget, you know, to put my hands on a wolf for the first time.
Do you remember my buddy Wade Nolan?
But Wade was a dear friend.
Yeah, man, Wade.
I really miss him.
We traveled the world together for many, many, many years. And we first met in Alaska in 84, I think it was. We were sighting rifles in. But it was, I mean, he's been dead now for about 5 or 6 years. I'm trying to remember which year it was. But I was at his house, and we were coming back the dirt road one time, and we passed this one house, and he was telling me about this one woman that lived there. She runs all the time. She liked boxing. She was very athletic, and that she was getting ready to move to Alaska, and she was going to be helping, I think, with some of the handicapped or disabled children. And she moved to a place called Pilot Point. And this is in the new book that I'm working on right now. I just told the story in this a couple of days ago in the book. But she went out for a run. And I'm bringing this back to wolves. There hadn't been a wolf attack like this in quite a while, because they're spooky. Yeah. They're really spooky.
Oh, yeah.
And she went out for a run, long-distance run. Nobody was with her. And all they found was what was left, and there were wolf tracks everywhere.
Oh, my goodness. Are you serious?
You have to look it up. So it was in Pilot Point.
Okay.
You can Google this. You can find the woman's name in there. But so let's kind of bring this back to your book, because wolves, the way that they can be so elusive, and the way that they can really, you know, stalk their game, I mean, they're an incredible predator. Tell me a little bit about decoys of deception, because when you think about that, was the way you opened the book, was a great wolf story.
Yep.
Move into the book a little bit for those guys listening to this.
Absolutely. So I do follow in the book the same thing I do when I produce TV or documentary or whatever, and that is entertain in order to grab the attention quickly. You gotta just a little bit of time, use that tease of entertainment to get them to watch the show, read the book, listen to the song. You gotta hook them with that hook, line, and song. Then I quickly try to set it up by chapter two. We're moving into the definition of hunting. So I've got the wolf story, and I've got the story of hunting with Phil Robertson. Those lead into the method of the madness, and that is to define what hunting is. And here's what hunting is: to deceive the animal into thinking that it's safe so that you can do what? Kill it.
Yeah.
Eat it, grill it, stuff it, mount it, wear it, whatever. And that's what hunting is. And fishing is the same thing. And so taking those definitions, I'm applying those to Satan, who is the world's greatest hunter. He has the biggest trophy room. He's got the most kills, everything. And so the book is about Satan and how he hunts us, because we are the prey. So in this case, we're the prey. We're the wolf from the opening story. And he has this blood popsicle knife that he is using in our life. And so the book moves into not only the origin of evil, the definition of who Satan is, all the various names that were used. It's kind of like a college study at this point about Satan. And all the various theories, where did his minions, his demons come from? And of course, we go back to Genesis, and I even look a whole lot at the Apocrypha and the intertestamental period, the Pseudepigrapha, and all of these works, not as inspired scripture, but as informative writings. And because that's how they thought back then, and that's what they wrote. And so we're looking at all these various theories about Satan and who he is, and you know, it was mind-boggling to me to do a journey through the Hebrew and then into the Greek. So I started with the Old Testament. I used my Hebrew training to do the study on the word for Satan. I was just blown away by what I found. I could not believe the fact that Satan does not even appear in the Bible until you get almost to the end of the Pentateuch. And I'm like, whoa, you ask every Christian at every church you come to, where is Satan introduced in the Bible? And all of them are going to say, he's in the garden. Okay. And I hope you can't see what's behind me back here, because there's a lady changing. We're here at the beach. So I just have to look at my rear view mirror, and she and her husband or her boyfriend are.
That's
so
funny.
That's just awesome. We're talking about decoys of deception.
So
right?
Just real quick, we were doing a TV show. Remember Day of Discovery? We were doing a show in Puerto Rico, and we did the entire thing and didn't know that there was a Hooters umbrella in the shot the entire time. So I had to cancel. It was like, oh, this whole day of shooting, we had to go
hilarious.
Back.
That's hilarious. That's so funny. Yeah, I'm gonna try to
get a little different angle here. So now you're, the viewership's going to go up. Guys are going to be going, hey, what? Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, my gosh. So with this whole thing with the deception and the way you kind of go with the story and Satan. Sorry. Satan shows up right when you're messing with us.
Hi there.
Oh, my word.
Yeah.
Yeah, the enemy knows exactly how to get a man's attention.
That's just timing right there.
It is.
All right. So what he's got strategies. He's got, and that's what I look at next, is that we look at Satan in the Old Testament, Satan in the New Testament. We look at Satan's strategies of the hunt. And it's all written in the 3 D's of Satan. So he's got, you know, he's trying to deceive us through distracting us so that he can then get us desensitized. Okay, we're good now. She's put a little cover up on. Thank you, lady. And so he's trying to desensitize us. He wants to divide us so that he can bring death. So everything kind of goes with a D all the way through the book. And there's a very practical section when we get into how is Satan hunting. We look at the various weapons that Satan uses and the various strategies that he uses to hunt us. Because when you and I go after a white-tailed deer with a bow, man, you know that we got to work our rear ends off with, you know, all types of effort to get that big old buck. And we may put in a year or two of work, or at least a few months to get everything to come together in the way that it should be, so we can create the opportunity. If you think Satan doesn't work that way, then you don't have a clue who he is.
Because, yeah, that's right.
He is the most strategic hunter. He scouts you. He knows you. He knows what kind of popsicle you like.
That's right.
You'll understand when you read those.
Yeah, that goes back to the beginning of the book.
Yeah. He's got trail cameras on you, man. He knows your patterns. He knows, you know, when you come out and when you go in and all this stuff. And he's got a little journal on you. And if he himself is not after you, he's got somebody assigned to you. And why is that? Because he wants you dead. And why is that? Because you're so important? No, because he wants to get back at God for kicking him out of heaven. And so what better way to get back at God than to hurt God's kids?
Yeah.
And we are God's kids. And so that's why we have to spend time understanding, studying the strategy of Satan. And then as I move into that third section of the book, that's where it gets super practical. How do we survive this?
Yeah.
And so it gets real practical. And we look at the Apostle John a lot. We talk about, you know, how Satan is having his way in progressive Christianity in the church. He's having his way in politics and the division that's going on in our country, in our homes, in our own individual lives. He's having his way in so many other arenas. And I look at all of these, and it's a no holds barred back book, man. I tell people at the beginning, I'm writing this book as if it's the last thing I'm ever going to write. And so I'm not holding anything back,
Jimmy,
on this one.
I started looking at that
in
a coffee shop this morning. And I love it. You know this. When someone comes up and they bought your book and they come back and they write you an email or they call you and say, man, I couldn't put the book down. As a writer, you know, sometimes you look at what you've written and you think, man, I hope it has that effect. Your book had that effect on me.
Yeah.
I sat there this morning and I kept, because I had to go pick up my youngest. It's the last week of school. And I kept reading and I'm like, okay, I had this much more time. Guys, it's really good. It's one of those things, like, I love writing stuff that holds someone's attention. When I got a hold of this morning, I'm like, yeah, I can't wait to finish this. It's really, really powerful, Jimmy.
The Roar Within is like that. And I remember the same thing. I get asked to do a lot of endorsements for books and all that. And sometimes I just don't have the time I want to read them. But when I picked up The Roar Within and started, dude, I was the same way. I cleared my calendar and I spent a day going through that book. And you did a phenomenal job on that.
Well, thank you. And that's, I think there's that our spirits resonate. We love the outdoors. We love fighting for the hearts of men because we want to see men set free. We know when we've hit bottom, it's like what you're saying in this book, what's going to get you out of that? You know, that book, I think I told a story of, I can't remember if it was that or Into the Wilds, where I got sucked to the bottom of a whirlpool. I was on a fishing trip, and I hit a log or a rock, whatever it was, at the bottom, and a man asked me later, he says, was it a good thing or a bad thing you hit bottom? I said, it was terrible. Didn't you hear the story? He says, wait a second, this was a whirlpool, right? And I said, yeah. He said, how deep was this? I said, like 14 feet. He said, what would have happened had you only been sucked into 10 feet, 8 feet, or even 4 feet? I said, I'd have died. He said, let me ask you again. Was it a good thing or a bad thing you hit bottom? Wow. You know, it's those kind of insights that you said that with your church, with everything that happened back then, and that I had the same kind of a story, we wouldn't know God the way we know him now, and becomes our why, because we want to see men who are going through stuff going, no, this isn't the end. This is the beginning of what God, the story that he's creating, saying, I'm free because of grace.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And I really hammer that hard in one of the chapters. One of the chapters is called Reversing the Rhythm, and it's a story about me and Phil Robertson in the duck blind. And we get to talking about this in between shooting ducks, because we'd shoot ducks for a little bit, and then he'd Phil to get his old Bible out, this old stained with water and ink and all that. And he'd be thumbing through it, and we'd be reading the Bible and talking. And then all of a sudden he'd go, duck, ducks, and we'd put him down and start calling, and we'd shoot ducks. Well, in one of the lulls, you know, we did that, and I used a shotgun shell analogy. And in the book, there's one of those little scan codes that you can literally go to the video and watch it, where they filmed this talking, and I use a red shell and a black shell analogy. And what it boils down to is that so many Christians have reversed the rhythm. We get works before grace. We think that we have to work well and earn the grace, and that there's no way on earth we'll ever have peace if we go that route. We can't earn grace. We can never be good enough. And so we're always going to feel guilty. And so if we'll get the rhythm back the way God intended it to be and have the grace first, and so because I'm saved, I get to do these beautiful works for God, then that's peace and joy. All right. Yeah. And I remember Phil goes, I like it, Shotch. I like it.
Hey, on a personal note, I don't know
if he ever knew my first name.
How is he doing? I mean, I've seen the news reports. I don't know whether you stay in touch with the family at all.
That's all I know. I saw Alan not long ago. We were speaking at National Day of Prayer for something, and I asked him about it, and he said that he is digressing. I think it's Alzheimer's that he's got.
Yeah.
I hate to hear that. Man, what a great guy. That dude, I'm telling you what, you talk about somebody real now.
And someone who made a huge impact. I think when I first started doing game dinners around 2007, I think it was, he and I were doing the same events for the same amount of money. That changed. And it wasn't my end.
Yes, it did. I know.
Well, man, I can't wait. So I really can't wait to get into the rest of this book. I mean, guys, again, it's coming out June 10th. Perfect gift for Father's Day. Maybe it's the gift to yourself, whatever you want to do. We're going to make sure we get that put back up on the screen. Is there anything else about the book or anything with that you really want to encourage the guys with today before we kind of close out?
No, I just simply say there are a lot of charts in the book because I like to be very practical and I want things to be applicable. And so there are some charts in there that I encourage people just to print out and put on their mirror or on their door where they change or whatever. Some that have to do with politics, some that have to do with, seven things that you can do to hunt God because God's hunting you, just things like that. And so I'd recommend look at those charts. And then the other thing is get the study guide. The study guide can be used with small groups, life groups. It can be used as a devotional with you and your family, or you can just go through it individually. The study guide helps you really digest the book in sections. And I think it's 12 sessions on the study guide. So, I would highly recommend that. They'll all come out on June the 10th, and you just get them at Amazon.com. You go in and type.
And I want to encourage you guys.
Deception book.
Check this out. I think you and I could both, if we were to say some of our favorite moments are on hunting trips with our buddies, because there's a connection that happens where it doesn't happen anywhere else. Kind of like guys that go to war together. There's just a band of brothers that comes out of that. And so, guys, absolutely, I want to encourage you to look up the book. To pick this up, to get the workbook and do something together with your buddies, because that, I always say that, I know who my six guys are that are going to carry me out when that time comes. Yep. And one of them said to me one time, he goes, oh, I'm honored that I'm going to be one of those six guys carrying you out. He goes, how about if I can be one of those six who carry you through life? And so
that's good.
Yeah. I think that is so important, guys. Yeah. We need that. We need to be able to have that safe place.
Well, I've got them and I need them big time.
Well, it's encouraging sometimes, on Facebook Messenger, we'll kind of reach out, kind of check in, see how each other's doing. And man, I hope you have and what is it exactly again in Tampa you guys are working on right now? I know you're on the book tour.
Well, I'm just doing a podcast and television tour right now. So like every day starting tomorrow, I'm going to be on podcast and TV shows for CTN.
Okay.
Christian Television Network. They cover about 70% of the world, and they're going to be promoting the book as well. And they also air Spiritual Outdoor Adventures every week. You know, we have 292 episodes, and so every single week another refurbished episode is on. So CTN is they're a wonderful group of people. Love them dearly. One of the owners is Bodie, and Bodie and I fished together last year after I did an event, and that's when I caught the 14-pound bass. It was unbelievable, man.
That's nuts.
We were in a little 10-foot John boat. It was the most Bubba Redneck thing you've ever seen. He's using a Ronco pocket fisherman. That's all he had. it was the funniest thing. And then I catch this 14-pound bass. Never caught a bass over 10 pounds in my life.
I thought you were going to say it was like a Zebco 33 or something.
Dude,
like,
we were freaking out. I mean, it was so funny. And I got that fish in, and I was shaking. My heart was going out of my head. I kissed her and threw her back. And I was just like, and I told Bodie, I said, you know, there's only two females on this earth that have ever made me completely weak-kneed and almost like faint. And you know, I kissed both of them, and I kept one, and I threw the other one back, and it was that bad.
Wow. And there you go. There's one of those one-ups. You want to keep it to have it to show everybody, right? Well, guys, thank you so much for tuning in today. And Jimmy, what an honor and a pleasure to have someone out there I knew who was doing battle for the hearts of men in the same way that I love, through the venue of the outdoors, this incredible place that God has created for us to take in. So let me just kind of encourage you guys at the end of this, and we talk about this so many times, is when a man knows who he is in Christ, that he's been created in the image of the living God, when he is no longer held captive by the opinions of others or cares whether he lives or dies, that man is now extremely dangerous, dangerous for good, because he's been unleashed. You've heard one of my brothers today who totally gets that. I want to encourage you to go out and get his new book. You got the link on the website. We'll put it up again. But Jimmy, thank you so much for taking this time with us.
Oh, thank you, Brent. It's an honor to be on with you, man. You're one of my heroes, and I really appreciate what you do.
Thank you,
buddy. Always good seeing you.
Yeah, you too. We'll touch base later. Good seeing you, man.
Sir.